So about 4 years ago, I blew up my life. You could call it a midlife crisis, I suppose. I mean, I even grew my hair into a long ponytail. But I don't really believe in midlife crises. I blew up my life. And I say I because I think that's important. Nobody else blew it up. I blew it up with my decisions. Sure, there were other people involved. There were circumstances. There was context. Maybe there was even good reason. But I made certain decisions over other decisions. And the decisions I made blew my life up. So I'm not going to give you the whole context tonight, but let me give you a snapshot. In the span of 4 months, I quit my job, and I ended my marriage and relationship that I'd been in for 18 years. Now, quitting a job is always hard and difficult, right? It's always changed. But for me, my work wasn't just a job, it was my life. It was everything to me. It was who I was. I worked 60-plus weeks every week, pouring myself into my work, into the community. It was a part of my identity. It was at the core of who I was, which was both beautiful and absolutely suffocating. And then there was my marriage, my relationship, to still one of the most wonderful women I'll ever know. A relationship that began at 18 years old. We grew up together. It was the only family I had ever known, and the delicate balance of ecosystem of relationships and family around that, through those decisions, absolutely shattered. And everything changed. I blew up my life. This wasn't a midlife crisis. This was a full existential crisis. So it was right after Thanksgiving, 2011, about 4 months into my separation and about 2 weeks after I had resigned from my job. And I'd been seeing a counselor for a lot of years. In fact, my wife and I had seen this counselor as far back as 2006, and I'd been seeing him even a year before the separation. And he had always talked about me doing this thing that he called an intensive. Now, what I understood an intensive was that I would be sequestered by myself for 3 weeks in a secluded place, and the only person I would interact with for 3 weeks would be my counselor. That was it. And this intensive was really it was meant to be a monastic experience, a desert journey, a stripping you bare from everything, every comfort, every distraction to help you get at the core of what was going on inside of you. Well, I was kind of out of excuses, wasn't it? Wasn't I? I mean, my life was a mess. I mean, for the first time in my whole life, I didn't have any responsibilities the next day. I woke up and had nowhere I had to be. No one necessarily, needing my time. So the excuses were gone. I said, sure, let's do it. So I remember driving out to the place that would become my home for the next 3 weeks. And it was a stormy day. I mean, a raging storm. The wind blowing so hard that the rain was coming in sideways. And I'm on this remote island road, one of the small islands, many small islands that populate the Puget Sound. And at the end of a remote road on a dead end is what will be my home for the next 3 weeks. And it's a manufactured home. And it's rustic. Not good rustic, right? Not like chic rustic, right? Like absolutely the worst rustic you could think of. No aesthetic pleasure whatsoever. Absolute plainness and bareness and ugliness. And I walk in and it is cold and dank and dark in there. And I struggle to find my way to the lights to turn some lights on and to the thermostat to begin to turn on the heat to thaw it a bit in there. And I scope out the place and I begin to unpack. First my groceries, then I pick the front bedroom and I hang my clothes and put them in the drawers. And then I set my journal on the kitchen table and a pen and one deck of playing cards and a fifth of single malt scotch. And that was it. That was all I was allowed to bring. I mean, I really wasn't new to solo retreats, right, or solitude. That was something I'd done, but I had never done it for 3 weeks. And I had never done it without books and an iPod or my laptop. And certainly there was no TV in this place either. There was nothing. None of those distractions, none of those things were welcome. In fact, it was contraband to even bring the deck of playing cards, but I thought, come on, I mean, I can at least play a few games of solitaire, right? And I wasn't supposed to bring alcohol, but there was that fifth of single malt scotch, plus two bottles of wine and a half rack of beer. Well, I sat down that first evening to begin my journey. I had started a pot of coffee, and I sat with that hot cup of coffee in my journal, and I wrote this line. The first line in my journal was, "There is a storm raging outside, and there is a storm raging within me." And I continued to write, and when I'd finished writing, finally, it was dark, and I had nothing else to do, and so I thought, I'll cook dinner. And so I cooked, and I cooked slowly, which became my tradition on this journey, to cook slowly, as slow as I could. I mean, I would chop things into the tiniest of bits. I began doing carrot and cucumber art, carving faces and making shapes. I made the most amazing cucumber totem pole you have ever seen, and I couldn't bear to eat it, so I sat it on the counter for display until it dried and spoiled finally. And then I came up with this game to try to make with the most creative sauces and things I could with the most rudimentary elements that I had there, right? And so I would throw the most god-awful things together in an effort to just try to engage my brain in some ways. I mean, there were times it got so bad that I literally couldn't eat what I just spent 2 hours making, and I would just have to eat a bowl of cereal. But somehow my better judgment as a fairly good cook gave way to just my desperation. I would walk every day, in the morning and in the afternoon. I probably walked the entire island by the end of it. And I wouldn't talk with anybody. My only acknowledgement as I saw the people coming and going on their ways was simply a wave of the hand or perhaps a nod of my head that was ensconced in a hoodie sweatshirt the whole time. And I begin to imagine what their lives were like. And then I begin to imagine, you know, myself in my version of their lives and what that life would be like. And at that particular time, I thought, this is really good because I want anyone else's life but my life right now. And I would take lots of walks in the woods, and I would look at the birds, and I would climb trees. And I would climb the trees as high as I could get. I mean, I'm not really built for climbing, as you can see. Michael would be a better climber than me, I think. I'm the opposite of that, right? No one has ever asked me to be on top of a pyramid. But I would climb as high as I could possibly get. And then I would sit. And I would think about how long it would take for someone to find my body if I had fallen. And who would still come to my funeral? And what would they say now that I had ruined my legacy? And I would find hiding places in the forest, dug out places of dirt and old huge trees that had fallen and rotted away. And I would lay myself in the wet, warm moss. And I would cry myself to sleep, replaying all the regrets of my life like a sad horror movie. And I finally got to a point where I thought I was going fucking crazy, right? Crazy with grief. I couldn't spend one more minute thinking and reflecting and meditating. I couldn't do it anymore. And so I, you know, in full disclosure, I tried to ration that alcohol. I tried to ration it for the first couple days, and on the third night, I got blackout drunk. And all the alcohol was gone by the fourth day. And so then I began to play solitaire, anything to distract me, right? And not only was I playing games of solitaire, but can you imagine, I was tracking the games. How long did the game last? What was the result of the game? I had a solitaire ledger. I mean, who does that? And then I began to make up other games with the journal, right? I was sketching out the different the possible lineup for the Mariners that coming spring, or dream football or basketball or baseball lineups for the ages. I was a high school football coach at the time, so I was drawing up crazy formations and plays that I might use someday. It got so bad that I actually looked forward every day to taking a shit. Because it was the only pleasure I had. It was the only moment that I felt like I was accomplishing something. But those first couple weeks, they strip it away, and they strip it away, and your pain gets very close. And I would just start to weep uncontrollably from nowhere, and rage would well up within me from nowhere. And I told my counselor this, and you want to know what he did? He walked to the closet, and he pulled out a shiny new axe, and he handed it to me. And he said, take this axe and take your rage and go into the forest and find a tree to chop. I shit you not, he gave me an axe. Someone in my state, an axe. I thought, what would the neighbors think? Have they come accustomed to strange men screaming and chopping things in the woods? But you know, that axe was like a primal medicine. And I would take it into the woods, and I would chop for hours until blisters formed on my hands, and my hands bled, and I screamed, and I chopped at all the disappointment, at all the regret, at all of the fear and anger and sadness and shame. And I chopped until I couldn't chop anymore, until I collapsed in the dust and the dirt and the bark around me, sobbing and sweating. And for days that went on, and it seemed like nothing would move. I would walk, I would cook, I would chop, I would shit. And then on the third day before I would leave, it happened. My counselor said to me, we're going to do a reflective exercise today, Tad. I want you to create a room, and I want you to fill that room with all of the people that you love most, all of the people that you are most afraid you're losing, all of the people that respect you who will no longer respect you, all of the people who have been your companions, your family and friends that will no longer count you as such. Put them in that room. And see, here's the thing about me. I really want to be liked. I want you to like me. I want you to respect me. I want to have a place. For as long as I can remember, I have spent my whole life on this mouse wheel 24/7 trying to belong, trying to prove that I was worthy because I didn't feel like I was, trying to make everyone happy, to keep this perfect eco-balance in place. And so I put those people in that room. And then he said, I want you to say to them everything. Everything that you've wanted to say. Everything that is true about who you are. Everything that you've been afraid or ashamed to share. I want you to bare your soul in the most complete way. And after gathering my thoughts and my courage, I spoke. And it spilled out of me, along with the tears. And I don't know how long I spoke, but I spoke with a kind of clarity that I've never spoken with before about such things. And there was this freeing silence. And I'm not sure how much more time passed before my counselor said, and now I want you to imagine that the thing you fear most has come true. I want you to imagine that they all leave. With no understanding, no compassion on their faces, they leave, and they never, ever come back. And I began to panic. I I began to panic and sob and cry out and scream and beg, "Don't go! Don't go! I'm sorry! Don't go! I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll be whatever you need me to be. Just don't go. Don't leave me alone." And somewhere in the midst of that primal anguish, something clicked and I realized, "Dad, you don't have any fucking control. You've thought all this time that you are controlling this, and you have no control. Whether you do right or whether you do wrong at the end of the day, you have no control. You're trying to control something that you can't." And what settled in was a sense of freedom and a sense of relief. A sense of relief that I didn't have to try that hard anymore, that I could let go. And finally, after some more silence, he said, "My counselor, have they all gone?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "What is left?" "No," he said. "And are you alone?" And I said, "Yes, I'm alone." But then I hesitated. I said, "No. No, actually, I'm not alone." And he said, "What is left? Who's there with you?" And I said, "I am left. I am here." And not only that, there is some larger presence in this place. Call it God, call it true essence, call it the universe, call it what you want, that was there in that place holding me. And then he said, "And is it enough? Are you enough?" And I thought long and hard about that question. And finally I said, "Yes, it is enough. I am enough." But I quickly added, "It's not all that I want. I still don't want to be alone. But it's enough. And it's more than I realized." Well, I'd spend a couple more days alone on that island. And there was great comfort in that aloneness and solitude in those days. And I knew that there was a lot ahead of me yet. And I would walk every day past the axe, which was leaning on the front steps, the new rains washing off the blood and the dust. And on the last day I was there, I met with my counselor for my final session. And when the session ended, he hugged me. It was the first time anyone had touched me in 3 weeks. And I began to cry. And I held on, and I couldn't let go. And I sobbed, and I was afraid of leaving him and leaving that island. But he just held me. And then he said, "Tad, you're not alone because you've realized that your deepest companion is God and yourself. But also, when you get back, you won't be alone. There will be people waiting for you, people that you know and people that you've not even yet imagined, people that will hear you and see you, people that will hold you and be held by you, and you will be able to hold and be held better now because you have learned to hold yourself more fully, more truly. And there will be loss," he said. "Grieve it. Let it go. Be who you are, let them be who they are, and bless them." Well, it's been over 3.5 years now, and I'd like to say that this is a fairy tale or a heroic story, but I am not a hero, and there are no fairy tales. Courage came slowly, and it is still coming. There are wounds that have been healed, and there are wounds that may never be healed. There have been forgiveness, and there is forgiveness for myself and others that has yet to come and perhaps never will come. About 3.5 months ago, I became a father. and I love him so much. And you want for your child to not have to learn lessons the same way you had to learn them. You want to protect them. But I don't believe that's possible. I believe he will learn in the same messy trial and error way that the rest of us learn. But his name is Ames, and his name comes from the narrator and main character of Marilynne Robinson's book, Gilead. And I took words from that novel and from T.S. Eliot's poetry to write a blessing for him that I spoke into the night upon his birth. And in some ways, it's not only a blessing for him, it's a blessing for me. And it said, Ames, may you be a friend to many, a friend of many, but most importantly, a friend to yourself. You are the beloved of God and of your mother and I. And I love you mostly simply for your being, for your existence, for your humanity. Son, you are the music. You are the sunlight. You are the winter lightning. If you go on trying, you will never be defeated, living on the significant soil of this life. I thought and prayed a lot of things for you today, my son, but it all pretty much boils down to this. Be free. Be free. Just the other night, I came home to a place where I belong with Ames and his mother, Holly. And I found that there was a new mat, doormat, at the front of our door. And I looked down and saw emblazoned upon that mat simply the words, be free. And as I looked and stared at that mat, I remembered that lonely island, the place I learned to be alone, the place I learned to belong first to myself. And then I walked through that door. Every day, I am walking through that door, trying to be free.